Now we come to the first night experience in chapter 3, and we don't have any difficulty understanding this is a distinct section of the poem because the term night after night means we've changed from a daylight setting in the second section in the wilderness invitation to a nighttime scene. We learn here about the watchmen of the city. They are a new character brought into the narrative. But we also have in this section a repetitive Leitwörter and Leitmotif, keyword, the word seek and find. It is used twice in verse 1, that is the word seek. It is used twice again in verse 2, and the word find is used once in each of the first 4 verses. So there are 2 key words in this section which mark it off from the rest of the book. There is a leitmotif, that is, there's a key theme here, which is repeated as well in each of the first 4 verses. Him whom my soul loves, or whom my soul loves. That theme, bracketing the seeking, finding refrain, comes to its conclusion in verse 5 with an appeal to the daughters of Jerusalem once more, even as we saw that in verse 7 of chapter 2. Now, there is a dramatic tension in this portion of the book. That seeking in verse 1 is a Hebrew pi'el. Now, that won't mean much to most of you, but the pi'el form of the Hebrew verb is an intensification of the sense of the meaning of the verb. So when it says that she sought him, it is an intensified seeking. It is intensified to the point of being a frantic searching. She is in a virtual state of frenzy, searching for the one whom her soul loves. And you will notice that it is the female who is speaking. She is the active pursuer in this section of the narrative. She is moving vigorously about searching for the one whom her soul loves. She is moving from a position of lying down in verse 1 to rising up in verse 2. She searches her house unsuccessfully. She rises up to go out into the city, verse 3, and she searches the city unsuccessfully. Now, in addition to the frantic character of her searching, there is an element of suspense introduced into this section, the suspense of seeking but not finding, the suspense of hanging upon seeing her search the house and search the streets of the city and not discovering him whom her soul loves. But she does find the watchman. The watchmen in verse 3 are the guardians of the walls of the city. They are the protectors of Jerusalem. They are those who do not threaten her. They are those who are drawn in company with her into her search. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? She does find him, and she brings him home holding tightly to him, so that in this unit we not only have a setting of a nighttime search motif, we also have elements of contrast. Contrast between lying down and rising up. The contrast between being in the house and being in the streets of the city. The contrast between seeking and finding. This nighttime scene is a scene of vivid contrast. Now, 3:1-5 is very tightly knit in the Hebrew text. It is taught with tension. You will notice the fourfold occurrences of the phrase, sought him, 2 times in verse 1, 2 times in verse 2. Him whom my soul loves, finding, not finding, once in each of the first 4 verses. The transition which occurs between the seeking and the finding is that the one whom her soul loves is positioned between those two parameters. Between the seeking, she comes upon him so that he is found. The male, once again, at the center of this unit. Even though he never speaks. Notice something further. The resolution which marks the shift from her frenzied seeking and not finding, that resolution occurs in verse 3 when she is found. Very significant. She is found by the guardians, the watchmen of the city. She then finds the guardian of her love. The dramatic shift from the beloved sought and not found to the beloved found crosses through her being found. Must she give herself up? Must she give herself up to being sought and found herself before she can find the love she seeks? Must she discover herself found of him whom her soul loves in order to cease the frantic searching and never finding? I believe that the watchman in 3:3 function as a sober reminder to her frenetic and relentless searching. Frenetic and relentless searching, but not finding passion. I believe that the watchmen function as a sober reminder that her not finding him, but she being found of him, is the key to the transition in the section. The absence of the word sought in verse 4 is poignant. It does not appear in that verse. She found him because he first found her. She held tight to him because he first held tight to her. She would not let him go because he first embraced her and would not let her go. Must she realize that at the crossroads of the transition, she must give herself up to being found by him? And she is not her own anymore. Is the story then any less poignant? Is this narrative any less poignant? The seeking, the finding and seeking. Is this any less poignant when the lovers are Christ and his bride? Now, the structure of this section, as I said, is taught. You will notice on your sheet that I've given you the narrative chiasm with an A, B, C, D, C prime, B prime, A prime relationship. And at the opening of the chiasm, she longs for him in her room. Verse 1. Verse 2, B, she goes to search for him. Verse 3a, first part of verse 3, letter C, she is found by the watchman. And the question, which is the point of transition, letter D, is, have you seen? 3b. C prime, she finds, very same Hebrew word for found in C. She finds her lover for A. B prime, she returns home for B. She went out searching in 2B section. B prime, she returns home for B. A prime, they are together again in her room, verse 5. Verse 4 and 5. Now, this chiasm, if you draw the lines between A and A prime, vertical lines, B, B prime, C, C prime, this chiasm, again, is a parallelism. And it is a parallelism in which this relationship is undergoing tension. It is tension in the form of alienation. An alienation which produces separation and distancing. Those tensions, that sense of alienation and distance in the relationship requires an active initiative in order for the reconciliation of the tension to occur. Somebody has to take the first step. And here, the female character pursues a restoration of the relationship. She initiates pursuit in seeking her lover, whom she cannot find, who has grown distant from her. Now, if you notice what is happening, as we put the prologue and the first invitation section and this nighttime section together, if we look at them as a consecutive story, we look at the prologue in terms of hesitancy and self-doubt, coming to resolution in verse 6 of chapter 2, let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me. Then in the wilderness invitation, the remoteness or the barriers that have come between them are resolved in verse 16 of chapter 2, my beloved is mine and I am his. Now here in this third section, in the nighttime narrative, the alienation or separation is also resolved. I found him whom my soul loves, verse 4. In each section, then, in each unit of the poem, where there is this tension, where there is this sense of frustration, barrier, or alienation, there is resolution and reconciliation. They are brought back together. They are reunited. And I want you to mark that as you meditate upon the book, because it is so fundamental to the love relationship that the healing, resolution, and reconciliation of the love, frustration, and alienation and estrangement is the sweetest experience of that reunion and relationship. It's being dramatically portrayed here in this poetic drama. This key to standing in Christ and out of Christ, standing reconciled to one's lover, able to resolve the tensions, the alienations, the distancing, but realizing that in achieving that reconciliation, someone has to step out. Someone has to be the pursuer. Someone has to break the ice. Someone has to make the first step. And here we see her doing it. It's not wrong for a woman to take the first step to reconciliation and resolution. If the distancing is there, there's a sense of tension. The wife senses it. Nothing wrong for her stepping out and saying, I'm seeking him whom my soul loves. Well, we move on then to the next unit, which is chapter 3, verse 6 to chapter 5, 1. It is the journey to the wedding night. And this unit ends, as I pointed out last night in chapter 5, verse 1, with God's benediction. Eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers, God's benediction upon the wedding journey. The curtain falls then at the end of this section with the voice of God. The curtain falls upon their love making, consummated in the ecstasy of sexual union. That is the goal, which is the center hinge point of the book. Now, this unit, which ends with the wedding chamber, begins with a wedding cortege. The procession of the bride born within Solomon's couch, or his palanquin, which is what that word means. It means a traveling curtained couch. Therefore, we have a scene shift. At 3:6, we're not at night anymore. We're looking at a curtained couch being borne on the shoulders of royal bearers carrying the bride up to Jerusalem in broad daylight. And in 5:1, we have the curtain falling upon their wedding night. So we have moved between 3:6 and 5:1 in transition from nighttime to daylight back to nighttime. And that scene delimitation is what marks this section off. So 3:6 to 5:1 are marked off because of the change of scene. We know it's a unit because we're dealing with a different setting. This wedding scenario, which takes up the material between 3:6 and 5:2, this wedding scenario moves from the procession of the bride to the reception by the groom to the physical description of the bride's beauty, heightened by sights and smells of love, to the sexual consummation in 5:1. This lovely section of the poem has been perfectly described as an epithalamium. Epithalamium, E-P-I-T-H-A-L-A-M-I-U-M. That is Origen's word, the great Alexandrian Egyptian church father. That is Origen's word for the Song of Solomon. He called it an epithalamium. He called it a wedding poem. And that's exactly where we are in this section of the song. Within the outer markers of this epithalamium, there are several subunits. And I'm going to work backwards here. I want you to notice chapter 4, verse 8, which reads, "You will come." Now, some of your versions may have just simply "come," but it is actually a future. "You will come." And notice verse 1 of chapter 5, "I have come." The very same Hebrew word or Hebrew root is used there to indicate the approach of the bride and the groom. Now, there is a further indication that 4:8 to 5:1 is a distinct subunit within this section. There is a unique Leitwörter in this unit, 4:8 to 5:1. He calls her his bride in verses 8 and 11 of chapter 4, and he doubles it by calling her his sister, his bride, in chapter 4, verses 9, 10, 12, and 5:1. That is the sole vocabulary of endearment in this subunit. Bride or my sister, my bride. Therefore, once again, 4:8, 5:1 are delimited by a peculiar, singular vocabulary. Now, contrast those keywords, bride or sister, my bride, contrast those key words with verses 1 to 7 of chapter 4. In that subunit, you will notice that the term of endearment is my darling, verse 1 and verse 7. In fact, my darling, beautiful you are, occurs in verse 1 and verse 7. Therefore, because those terms appear in verse 1 and 7, they form an inclusio around that portion of the poem. The subunit 4, 1 to 7 also includes the WASP, W-A-S-F. What's a WASP? W-A-S-F. It's an Arabic term for a physical description, and here in 4, 1 to 7, we have the first physical description of the female. The male describes her physical features in those 7 verses. So working backwards from 5-1 to 4-8, I have a delimited unit. From 4-7 to 4-1, I have another delimited unit. In between the inclusio of 4-1 and 7, I have a wasp, that is a physical description of the woman. That then leaves verses 6 to 11 of chapter 3 as the third and final subunit, or going forwards, the first subunit, 3, 6 to 11, second subunit, 4, 1 to 7, third subunit, 4, 8 to 5, 1. Now in verses 6 to 11 of chapter 3, there are no inclusios, but there is a Leitwörter, there is a key word. There's a key word which dominates those 6 verses, and it is the name Solomon. In verse 7, 9, and 11, the name Solomon is repeated. All right, let's go to verse 6 and analyze the movement within the subunits or subsections. I've indicated that this is the wedding cortege marching towards the wedding night. This is a wedding drama. In verse 6 of chapter 3, what or who is coming up from the wilderness? And the answer to the question is the bride. And how do you know? Because in verse 6, she is described as perfumed with myrrh. That would not fit a man. So there are those who have suggested that this is Solomon coming up. In verse 6, I think not. It is the description of the bride coming up, perfumed for her wedding day. Notice also that this phrase, what or who is this, appears in chapter 6, verse 10. If you want to turn to that for a minute. Who is this that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as the full moon? That is obviously a description of the girl. And in chapter 8, verse 5, who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? The only place in the Bible where that phrase, who is this, is used, is it's used of a woman. Therefore, in chapter 3, verse 6, it's the female. Now, where is she? In verse 6 of chapter 3. She is in the traveling couch. She's in the palanquin of Solomon. That is an enclosed image. She is closed in a curtained traveling couch. Why do I emphasize the enclosed image? Because throughout this poem, the form of an enclosed image repeats itself over and over again. In this case, the enclosed image is indicative of the fact that she is reserved for him alone. She is his exclusive possession. Now this is a lavish nuptial litter, verses 9 and 10. It's a sedan chair made from the timbers of the cedars of Lebanon, with posts of silver and gold and purple fabric. There is nothing too good for his woman as he brings her to the wedding day. No, it wasn't a stretch limo, but it was as good as they could get in that day. In verse 11, the procession arrives at Jerusalem and all the city comes out to welcome the arrival of the bride. Solomon's eager welcome includes his friends in the city. I want you to see the one that I love. So he wants to show her off. Then in verses 1 to 7 of chapter 4, he describes his darling. She appears before him and he breaks out in praise of her physical beauty. In verse 2, he says, your teeth are like the flock of newly shorn ewes which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins and not one of them has lost her young. Now, of course, that's exactly what you want to say on your wife on your wedding day, that your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes. She might just turn around and walk out on you. Well, once again, it's the sense of the imagery. He is suggesting that her teeth are like ewes because, of course, she's a woman and a ewe is a female sheep. But you'll notice that he describes her teeth as newly shorn ewes. That is, she is white, washed, and pure. It's not just that she's brushed her teeth. That's not the whole point. It's that she is the image of that, even in her teeth. Her teeth reflect the fact that she is washed and pure. And her teeth, which he describes as evenly matched pairs, I'm not suggesting that she had braces when she was a child, don't take it that far, but the point is that the teeth remind him of twins born or delivered by the ewe lamb. So he's drinking in all her physical beauty, and the point of describing her teeth is to create an image of how she is doubly beautiful, attractive, white, and pure. He's drinking in her physical beauty. She is stirring his affections, this his darling. Now in verses 8 to 15 of chapter 4, we have a development out of that physical description. He's moving beyond describing her physical features. He's very excited. You have made my heart beat faster, verse 9. His pulse is increasing. He is anticipating the consummation of their love. In verse 11, her kisses are sweet. They are dripping with honey. The loveliness of her scent, it is the sounds of her presence. The fragrance, sweetness, refreshing exhilaration of her love is an anticipation which he eagerly yearns for. Now, when we come to verses 12 to 15 of chapter 4, we have another enclosed image. It is a garden metaphor, a garden locked. The enclosed image is again the description of the fact that she is reserved or kept for him. She is exclusively his. This garden image is an indication of her virginal state. But in verse 16, awake, O north wind, and come, wind of the south, make my garden breathe out fragrance. Who is speaking? The bride is speaking. She is longing for him. She describes herself as a garden. She describes herself in terms of spices wafted abroad there in verse 16. She describes herself as one with choice fruits. And where did we see that vocabulary before? Where did we see my garden? We saw my garden in verse 12, a garden locked. Where did we see the spices of verse 16 before? We saw them in verse 10, all kinds of spices. Where did we see the choice fruits of verse 16 before? We see them in verse 13, your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits. Who was speaking in verses 8 to 15? He was speaking. Who is speaking in verse 16? She is speaking. How is she speaking to him? She is speaking as a mirror image of the way he speaks of her. He speaks of her as a garden of spices, a garden of choice fruits, and she describes herself as a garden of spices and choice fruits. Once again, this intimate reciprocity between the lover and the beloved. His description of her and excitement are expressive of his desire for her, his longing to possess her, and her self-description is reflective of his imagery of her, in her expression of longing for him to possess her. And in chapter 5:1, he has possessed her. I have come. I have gathered. I have eaten. I have drunk. Those are perfect verbs in the Hebrew. Perfect tense means it's an accomplished action. Consummation has occurred. From 3:6 to 5:1, we have a beautiful portrait of love which emerges on the wedding day. It is a mutual love. These lovers are a mirror image of one another on their wedding day. She yearns for him, he yearns for her, and I would add, with God's comment in 5:1, behold, it was very good. There is no domination here. There is no subjugation here. There is no sadism here. There is mutual complementary yearning and receiving. Second, we have an indication of the wholeness, the completeness of the love of our lovers. They desire that complementary union. They are eager to be completed by the other. And God says, eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply. God says that complementarity, that desire for wholeness, is the way I made you in the beginning. Not good for the man to be alone. I will make a complement. I will make a completer for him. Now you notice in the third place that this portrait of the wedding day is a portrait of their exclusivity. She is reserved for him. The locked garden image. The contained couch image. She is reserved for him exclusively and vice versa. He is reserved exclusively for her. Our lovers have left father and mother for one another. They are cleaving to one another exclusively. And God says, drink deeply. Finally, this wedding portrait is a wedding portrait of the consummate sexual pleasure of our lovers. They yearn for one another for love's sake. Their sexual expression is sweet and tender, passionate in an expression of their love for its own sake. It is love which moves him to describe her physical features with the gentleness and joy of verses 1 to 7 of chapter 4, and she delights in him, she pleasures him, and vice versa, he pleasures her. I want you to see that in this section of the inspired Word of God, there is no other factor in view than their lovemaking consummately. Nothing else. There is not procreation in this passage. There are not children in this passage. There is nothing but the exploring of one another intimately, affectionately, and passionately. Their love is satisfying. She satisfies him. He satisfies her. They reciprocally describe one another in the same imagery so that their mutual sexual pleasure is good for its own sake. Without any thought of procreation. The pleasure of love for love's sake. The pleasure of sexual intimacy for love's sake. Is this not what the Apostle Paul tells us in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 3 to 5? Do not deprive yourselves of one another except by mutual consent, that you may devote yourself to prayer and fasting. Fasting. The inspired apostle negatively says, do not deprive yourselves, and positively, do give yourselves to one another for no other ulterior motive than for love's sake. And God said, eat, friends, drink and imbibe deeply, O lovers. If the Roman Catholic Church has cheapened the notion of sexual intimacy, she has done it in perverse ways by isolating monks and nuns and also suggesting that married couples are second-class citizens. This book is an exuberant, ecstatic, delicate, and tender celebration of sexual love within marriage for its own sake. God says in the Song of Solomon, chapter 5, verse 1, God says, it is good. Let us never, never demean sexual intercourse to the level of the sullied or the ugly. Let us in the Christian church hold it up as the supreme expression of intimacy and union, because it is the metaphor of God's own intimacy with us. Any questions about this section? To fill in the blanks in the outline, the journey motif, 3:6-11, is Solomon's couch. The first inclusio, 4:1-7, my darling, in both 1 and 7. And then the second journey motif, which is actually from Lebanon, in verses 8-15, with the final mirror in 4:16 of her describing her beloved who has come into his garden, and in 5:1 as him saying he has come into his garden. And with that, I will take any questions or comments you may have, and we will finish the book after lunch. Yes. Well, how do I know in 5:1 that it is God speaking? First of all, it is the language of address. They are addressed in the plural. They are addressed as O lovers, which is a description of others. So therefore, this is a third speaker. This is somebody other than the two of them. And in this book, in which the love which God gave to Adam and Eve in the beginning is, in my opinion, being redescribed, even though it's under the era of the fall, I cannot think that God is completely absent. In fact, I can make a case in chapter 8, verse 7, as the flame of the Lord, where God's name is actually used, though I know that that's arguable. But nonetheless, to go back to my point, I don't think there's anyone else who fits. And consistent with my biblical theological interpretation, I think what's happening is a reprise here of Genesis 2 and 3, so that God's blessing is being repeated here on Solomon and his Shulamite, as it were, as a second Adam and Eve. Therefore, when the third party speaks, I don't know who else could speak this except God himself. Is that a gratuitous assumption? I think not. I think it's demanded from the context. The question is, am I making the assumption because the book is in the Bible? Is that the reason I'm suggesting that God is speaking here? In part, I am. In other words, the book is in the canon. It's regarded as inspired scripture, given by God to his people. And therefore, it would be reasonable for me to expect God to speak in it. Therefore, when I have a third-person speaker, undefined elsewhere by the context of the drama, I am appealing to the only one whom I think can make this kind of statement, namely God himself. Can I make my case other than the fact that it's just a love poem in the Bible? In other words, can somebody say, well, that's just your idea, Dennison. It's just another love poem that happened to get caught up into the Bible. Well, I don't think that there are any accidental love poems in the Bible. I think if there's a love poem that's in the Bible, it's in the Bible because God wants it there. And therefore, for me to expect God to speak in it, as in general, it's revelation, but for him to actually be a character in the drama, I do not think is unusual. And I could go back to some other parallel patterns where God is present in the drama. For instance, in the book of Ruth, where he doesn't specifically speak, etc., but he is appealed to, but he does not specifically speak. He's kind of the shadow character off stage, but he is definitely the one who is at the center of the drama in the book, arranging the details, etc. So I think it is not peculiar to the Song of Solomon. There are other books in the Bible that have this same pattern, but if you're asking me, can I prove that this is God's voice because it says that it's God's voice? No, I can't prove that, but I think it follows out of the biblical theological case that I'm trying to build for its inspiration. The book of Ruth is one that I know off the top of my head, and you're catching me a little flat on my feet with that question in general, but the book of Ruth is one. Esther. Yeah, there's the argument there about God's name in Esther, but yes, that's another one that is in the canon where God ostensibly does not appear, though I think he is definitely, again, at the heart of the narrative. Interesting that there are two books which deal with the female protagonists. Another question, yes? Well, I don't think so, but I must... Is there a question about the simile similarity in 3:6 about the pillar of smoke, or the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud in the Sinai Peninsula? I haven't thought about it, but that would be a question that you would have to use your Hebrew concordance to work on. In other words, take a look at the word for smoke here and any of the related vocabulary and take a look at the parallels. So I'm not going to rule it out, though I haven't thought about it. Yes, the possibility. Okay, the question is, why not from 3:11... where the city goes out to look at Solomon, and in 3:7, where the traveling couch is called the traveling couch of Solomon, why is it not Solomon who is inside the couch himself? And my answer to that is because I don't think that the perfume and myrrh in verse 6 fit the male image. Number two, I have tried to suggest that in verse 6 of chapter 3, that form only appears in describing the female character when that parallel phrase occurs elsewhere in the book. And so for those two reasons, for the most part, I think it is the female. Who is this coming? Wherever that phrase is used in the book, it's a Hebrew form. The same pattern occurs two other times in the book. Wherever it occurs with respect to the woman. Yes, because she's being paraded, she's being brought up to Jerusalem in royal procession. She's being treated as royally as he is being crowned in verse 11. Okay, the question is, the garden locked and the couch enclosed, the exclusive relationship, how does that reflect upon Solomon as the author of the book? I do believe that Solomon is the author. Because 1 Kings tells us that he wrote thousands of songs, and I think this is one of the songs that he wrote. So I don't have any problem with Solomonic authorship. But I'm surprised this question wasn't raised last night, because usually when there are women in the audience, it's the first thing they raise. What do you mean, this Lothario? He has how many wives and how many concubines at the end of his life? What's going on here? You're making him a hero here. Well, I'm making him a hero at the beginning of his life. Remember, I made my case last night for the opening of this book in the kind of the scene of young love. This is Solomon with his prize bride. I don't think he ever had it as good anymore. And I think his alliances with the concubines and multiple wives was an indication of his own spiritual decline, his own marital decline. So this book, I believe, was written earlier in his career with his first true love, and therefore it represents the purity of that love at that time in his life. When his life subsequently declined, and he examined all of life and found it empty and vain, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, Book of Ecclesiastes is a testimony to the fact that at the end of his career, he did find the emptiness even of those multiple liaisons with his wives and concubines. And at the end of Ecclesiastes, he comes back to his senses and says, here's the sum of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. In other words, there is a return at the end of Ecclesiastes of Solomon into the covenantal context. So I think Solomon is at his spiritual peak, so to speak, at the beginning of his life. He declines in the middle of his life, but he returns at the end of his life, having examined the emptiness and vanity of life with respect to its materiality in particular. And therefore, I have hopes of seeing Solomon in glory. But I think that's the reason it's in the canon. It comes from that stage of his life when his marriage represented the purity of the relationship between God and his people. Later on, that was not true. But that was because of his disobedience, not because of obedience, because of his obedience under the inspiration of the Spirit and the Song of Solomon. He does marry Pharaoh's daughter. That is true. That was a political liaison, and that may, you know, be behind the mare in Pharaoh's stable here in chapter 1. But I don't really think that the Shulamite is Pharaoh's daughter. I think she is before her. I think that when Pharaoh's daughter comes on the scene, Solomon is beginning to look for political alliances. You remember that in the historical context, when Solomon enters into those multiple marriages, he enters into them for economic reasons and for political reasons. He gets all kinds of trade benefits for those relationships. He gets trade treaties. He gets mercantile wealth that flows into Jerusalem as a result of those women in his city. And he gets political treaties. He has peace with his neighbors because of those multiple relationships. So he's moved. He's moved by political and economic considerations. He's not moved by the considerations of passion and affection. I think that's true in the case of Pharaoh's daughter as well. Correct. And she would have been one of the fair-complexioned maids, not one who is black but lovely. I can't comment on it because I never thought of it, but here's the observation. The observation is the imagery in 3:6-11 suggestive of the Holy of Holies or the temple court or the Ark of the Covenant, the imagery that rises from the building of the sanctuary of the Lord, both in the wilderness and in Jerusalem? And is it possible that the couple are themselves reliving the Exodus motif as they come up to Jerusalem? Yes, anything is possible. So, but I have not thought about that. I appreciate the suggestion, the observation. It's something that I would have to think about in order to say I agree or disagree. But it's certainly worth pondering. Yes, the question is there not a sense of repentance or turning around in the reconciliation? And I think that is true. In other words, whenever the relationship has become tense and there's been an estrangement in it, then obviously there's a turning around of it, which is the heart of the word repentance. The reconciliation that occurs at her initiative in that previous scene is a reconciliation that turns away that estrangement or whatever it is. In other words, it removes it. She turns away from it, takes it away, and it's solved. It's resolved. It's finished. It's taken care of. And yes, so that pattern in which she turns the corner or he turns the corner, as the case may be, in order to make conciliation, in order to restore peace to the relationship, in order to restore the intimacy to the relationship. I think that's foundational to the resolution motif. Yes. As she, the comment is, in 3:1-5, is there a reflection here of Christ first loving us? And yes, I think that you can make that step because she finds she herself is not in the position of resolution until she allows herself to be found by the guardians of the city. And in that sense, you see, there's a resemblance between Christ finding us before we first found him and us relinquishing ourselves to being found of him who first loved us. It's only a parallel grammatically. The comment is there support in the curtains that are also described in 3, for the curtains of the tabernacle, curtains of the temple? Yes, if we're going to go that direction, that definitely would be a theme to trace. But the superlative, namely Holy of Holies and Song of Songs, only grammatically similar. The comment is the sibling rivalry in chapter 1. Does it reflect upon Joseph and his brothers? Only indirectly, insofar as there's always sibling rivalry in a family. I don't think there's a direct connection here. Yeah, that's a possibility. I wouldn't rule it out. However, I don't think that we have another delimited physical description there. Okay, this is an image of her expressive beauty, not particularly focusing upon individual physical characteristics, which is what goes on in the wasp. So the wasp is an integral unit of purely physical description, anatomical description.